My guest today is Velcro Ripper. He's a Canadian documentary filmmaker, writer, and public speaker, best known for his Genie Award-winning 2006 film, Scared Sacred, and his newest feature document, Fierce Light, When Spirit Meets Action. His 1995 feature documentary, Bones of the Forest, won 12 major awards, including a Genie Award and Best of the Festival at the Hot Docs Canadian International Documentary Festival. Many of his films examine the intersection of spirituality and politics. Welcome to Conversations, Velcro.
Hey, great to be here.
It was great having you up in our area, in Nevada City, in the Sacramento area, to have your movie Fierce Light. I was just so moved and impressed. I had to run down here to San Francisco and learn more about what you're doing.
Yeah, it was great to be in Nevada City. I also taught a workshop there at a yoga studio on spiritual activism, and it was a wonderful community.
You know, one of the things that struck me, particularly in Fierce Light, was there's so much fear right now in the world.
Yeah.
And just at the very beginning, when with your friend,
Brad Will
being killed in the film, the camera falling and then shooting that last bit. And then when you walked in front of all those armed people, I thought, oh my God, where does somebody get the courage to do that? And of course, so much of your movie there is the marriage of activism and spirit. Can you talk a little bit about the fear in the world right now with the things that are happening and confronting that with spirituality?
Sure. Fierce Light is part of a trilogy, the Fierce Light trilogy. And it really began with Scared Sacred. And Scared Sacred was, you know, shot in I set off just at the eve of the millennium, 1999, and there was a lot of building fear in the world back then. Some people thought the world was actually going to end. I didn't, but there's actually enough realistic reasons why the world might end to really justify having fear. And with the intent of understanding that fear, I chose to actually go to the places that had experienced some of the worst humanity has ever met with, the ground zeros of the world, to look for strategies of how do we transform crisis into opportunity.
Well, let's talk about some of those places that you visited in that film.
I went to Afghanistan, both in the refugee camps during the time of the Taliban and then afterwards during the occupation that's going on right now. I went to New York City during 9/11. I went to Cambodia, Hiroshima, to Bhopal, India, site of the world's largest chemical disaster, leaving hundreds of thousands sick and close to 20,000 dead, and to Israel and Palestine during the construction of the wall, where I was actually shot at when I was shooting that film.
And you were shot at in Israel, Palestine?
In Palestine, yeah, by the Israeli Defense Forces, yeah. That's in the film. The question I was asking was, you know, the combination of those two words, scared and sacred, what happens when they come together? And initially I was going to go to the sacred places of the world and look for the sacred there and go to the scared places and find the scared there. But I started discovering the sacred in the places you least expect to find it, the places of darkness. Because in each place I went to, I found some of the most inspiring human beings I've ever met. Hiroshima survivors and Auschwitz survivors and the survivors of Bhopal who were able to transform what they had been through and keep their spirits intact. And I discovered there were two things that got them through. One was having a source of meaning, something that gave them a sense of meaning in their lives. And the second thing was taking action to try to prevent what had happened to them from happening to others. Somehow working to transform the situation. That gave them a way to continue, a way to find a sort of luminosity that they were so infused with, the fierce light that then led to fierce light. And I realized that the combination of spirituality and activism is a potent and necessary antidote, in a way, to the crises that we're facing.
Tell us some of the stories of the people that really inspired you, stories as they unfolded in your being with them and interviewing them.
And Scared Sacred, well, so many. The story of Aki Ra in Cambodia is quite remarkable. Aki was forced to be a child soldier by the Khmer Rouge, and And because he was small and light, he was forced to lay landmines. And he witnessed his mother and father both being killed because they were teachers. At that time, they would kill anyone with an education or glasses, even wearing glasses. So he witnessed that and went through that tremendous trauma as a child soldier. And then when finally the Khmer Rouge were deposed, Aki's source of healing for him was to personally go out into the countryside of Cambodia, and he learned how to become a D miner. Oh. And just with a simple wooden stick, he goes out and he takes out about 100 mines a day in his bare feet with a wooden stick, and because there's just thousands and thousands of mines throughout Cambodia. And this is tremendous. And he's also taken in orphans who've been victims of landmines. He's transformed his experience into one of healing, using the very substance of his suffering to transform him. Again and again, I saw these kinds of stories. And what really guided me, there were two things that really guided me on my quest as I went to the world's ground zeros, because I left that experience. You'd think, you know, wow, by now I'd be kind of a depressed person, you know, but all these places. But in fact, it left me with an unshakable sense of hope. And hope is a very important word to get your head around. It comes up in Fierce Light as well, because hope and optimism are not the same thing. Because optimism, and I love a Professor Cornel West quote, which was once in Scared Sacred, and then I cut it out, which I regret to this day. So I try to repeat it at every possible moment, because it should have been in the film. But what he said was that optimism is based on the facts. Looks pretty good out there. Things are going to get better. Whereas hope says it don't look good at all. But we're going to take the leap of faith to create new visions based on possibilities that become contagious, to encourage people to engage in heroic acts against the odds, no guarantee whatsoever. That's hope.
Reminds me of Julia Butterfly when she was in Luna and they had just killed her friend with a tree falling.
David Gypsy Chain.
Yeah. And she was weeping on the hill, and then she said she didn't have any hope, but if hope was alive with her, it was alive in the world, even if she was the only person. And I always remember that.
Yeah, and that's in Fierce Light. She says that in Fierce Light, and that's really such a powerful moment in the film, because at that point, other story points in the film is kind of, they've broken your heart open. Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge that we face time and time again in these times. How do we keep our hearts open in the face of this crisis and still have hope to carry on? Because despair, once you fall into the seduction of despair, it's all over. We need to face the extent of the reality of what's going on at this time in history right now. We cannot underestimate it at all. We're at a seminal point in history. We're at a place where we might actually blow it. And it's going to be the generations that are alive today that are carrying that responsibility. Big responsibility. In the next 10 to 20 years, these decisions are going to be made. And you know, we're not going to create the change we need without a sense of hope, and without a sense of humor too. Mm. I really think humor is so important. You know, one of my favorite moments in Fierce Light is when I ask Archbishop Desmond Tutu if he thinks that he
yes.
says, "Do you think that God has a sense of humor?" And he says, "Of course, God has a sense of humor. I mean, look at the creatures God creates. I mean, look at me with my big nose and short and stumpy." And then God has to say, "I have to love him," and then he just cracks up. Yeah,
yeah, you can't help but laugh to be around him.
Yeah,
talk a little bit about the role of grief and grieving in breaking the heart open and mm-hmm. finding that place of courage.
Yeah. Well, you know, Fierce Light is, at its heart, is about soul force, what's been called soul force. And it's the soul force of Gandhi, the soul force of Martin Luther King that they talked about. It's the soul force that you actually see radiating in all the characters in the film. And it's the synonym for me is fierce light. It's a fierceness of the heart. And that fierceness, ultimately, is about the fierceness to love no matter what. And that's something else that Julia talks about in Fierce Light. She says, I am not afraid to show my tears, because she cried when she told the story of losing David Gypsy Chain in that moment of hopelessness that she experienced in the tree. But she said, I'm not afraid to show those tears because I know that's where my power lies. That I'm able to keep feeling even when it hurts like hell. And that's Maybe especially. Or especially. Yeah, exactly. That's where the pedal meets the metal, you know, is an, at this, in fact, in our own lives, in our interpersonal relationships, you know, can we continue to keep our hearts open in the midst of everything? In the American Civil Rights Movement, they talk about the ability to see the divine spark in everyone. That's really helpful in interpersonal conflicts and keeping your heart open. The big challenge of the times, you know, I just interviewed Hannah Strong for the part 3 of the Fierce Light trilogy, which is called Evolve Love, The Meaning is Life. And she says, what we're experiencing is a malaise of the heart. It's a problem of love. And that's one of the theses of Evolve Love. It's love in a time of climate crisis. And how, you know, and how could the story we're facing of climate crisis be framed as one of the great love stories of all time? Because simultaneously, the climate crisis is breaking our hearts open. As we see, if we really open our hearts to what's happening to the planet, it's a reason for heartbreak. And yet, climate crisis could become one of the biggest unifying forces the planet has ever experienced. Because in order to really meet this challenge, we're all going to have to awaken our consciousness. We need a shift in consciousness to awaken to what we've been doing to each other in the planet and to return to love. And by love, I'm not talking about romantic love. I'm talking about that big capital L love that is really, ultimately, you know, in the mystics say God is love. I think quantum physicists would say the same thing. You can actually look at love as the actual force, the creative force of the universe. And I'm really excited in Evolve Love. It's also about the journey from the head to the heart and bringing that together, which is one of the big problems.
When is this coming out? Do you have a date?
2012. Yet? 2012. Yeah, we're just starting shooting now.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. One of the things, I was walking up the street here we are in San Francisco in the Haight. I remembered many years ago the times I spent here, and I was seeing the people on the street and thinking, you know, it's not just climate change, it's peak oil, it's peak everything, it's the damage that we've done to the ecosystem. In addition to that, we have a perfect storm brewing, as many people say, and it's probably going to happen very quickly now. I'm wondering, how are we going to get people to step out of the denial? We're so in what Thomas Berry calls the trance. You know, we're in such a trance. I mean, your movie is powerful, but what is it that you think will bring about that awakening? Do we have to have the worst of the worst happen, you think?
Right. You know, the Hopis have prophecies about this time. And their prophecies are all coming true. Many people have prophecies of this time. But what they say is that the prophecies can change if we manage to change. But if they don't, we are going to have the full, as Andrew Harvey says, we're going to have to go into the dark night of the soul as a species. Now, change is happening. It's maybe not happening in the north. To the same extent, it's happening in the South. The exciting news is in, like, South America, for example, where almost every country, with the exception of Colombia, which is like the Israel of the South America, with the exception of Colombia, every country is involved in some exciting, different social experiment. But the place that's exciting to me is Bolivia, with Evo Morales, the amazing Evo Morales. You should Google his speech at Copenhagen. And
I was there.
Yeah.
I was there.
He said it like it is. This is what's so great about it. And he is the first indigenous leader of a modern-day nation-state. And leading with a new form of governance, which is participatory democracy. And the people are connected to what's happening to that country. And it's coming. Now, this is coming from a place of a recognition of interconnectedness. You know, it's not the patriarchal dominator culture model, the industrial growth society model that is informing that country in the way that it is, you know, ours. It's a amazing, inspiring possibility.
And he's so humble, too.
Yeah, he is.
It's just amazing to be around him. It's like he's growing out of the earth almost.
Yeah.
And lots of other, I mean, the new constitution in Ecuador and Carrera, I think, are doing an amazing job. The first country to give rights to trees and rivers and mountains.
Yeah.
Equal.
We give rights to corporations as human beings, and it's like they give rights to the earth. What a difference in mentality. This is what we're up against, right? As Thomas Berry says so beautifully, we're suffering from a deep cultural pathology. So your question was, how do we wake that up? And it's a really important, really crucial question to ask, because we can do some Band-Aid solutions. But until we wake up, and until we're able to really face the facts and keep our hearts open and take action, nothing's going to happen. But the facts don't look so good. But I have hope. I have hope because there is a global shift afoot. There is an impetus. The planet herself is part of this impetus towards the awakening of a planetary civilization and a consciousness. And that's just, and it's a painful birthing process we're in. And, you know, you could say that society is a bit like in the adolescent stage, so even a little beyond, but maybe it's the terrible twos, you know, the me, ego phase, you know, and we have to get through to a spiritual maturity. And that's the challenge that we're facing. But the soul grows in the face of challenges. And so as a planet, that's the big challenge, is to come together as a human family, related to the planet, and part of the planet family.
Yeah. Part of nature, yeah. Not above nature.
Yeah.
I like Brian Swim's, that the planet's immune system mm-hmm. is kicking in.
That's
in
right.
us.
And we need to be the antibodies.
Yeah.
We need to come in and be that immune system.
The imaginal cells.
Yeah.
Same, like, that's a wonderful metaphor. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there are these unexamined assumptions and illusions. And I think the biggest one, and maybe this is ultimately what love is the illusion of being separate from mm-hmm. each other, separate from nature, separate from the earth that feeds us, from the air we breathe, from the, you know, the water. We hold ourselves somehow as separate from that. Perhaps that's really the key to discovering this, mm-hmm. this fierce love or fierce light mm-hmm. is in somehow going beyond that separation. And yet, and maybe this is part of the process, it seems like there is more adversarial, disconnected, finger-pointing separation, at least in our country and in our government, and it's fomented by the mainstream media on top of it.
Most definitely. And Chogyam Trungpa, the great Tibetan master, would call this the setting sun mentality. And sometimes the sun flares as it sets, you know? And that's the hope, you know? Collapse of the economic system is a good indicator that things are not working. And unfortunately, propping it up again was not the solution. Radical restructuring of a flawed, deeply flawed system is what's needed. And the opportunity, you know, activists used to always say, smash the state. I don't think we need to put our energy towards that so much anymore. The state's kind of doing a good job.
It's going to crumble on its own.
Crumbling on its own. You know, the work now is to create that new vision and work towards living that new vision, because we can live that. We, each and every one of us, can choose to start living a new world right now. And that's how it's going to happen. No one needs to tell anyone that they have permission to start living a new world. No one, you know, we can actually do that. Especially, now this isn't 100% true, but especially here in the North, where we have freedom of speech, where we have freedom of movement. You know, there are some countries where to actually, you know, break paradigms means you get killed. To take off your burqa means you get killed. To have women's rights means you get killed. We have a freedom here that, as Noam Chomsky says, gives us a moral responsibility to do something with them. Yeah.
One of the things the Dalai Lama has said recently, which I was very impressed by, was that actually the future of the world depends on Western women.
Hmm.
What are your thoughts about that and the rise of the feminine?
Right, yeah, key. You know, I mean, but it's not just the women. The men actually have to learn how to become non-patriarchal.
Well, also the feminine in our own, yeah.
We have to, basically, you know, my understanding is that, you know, and I've been reading a lot of bell hooks for the Evolved Love. I've just read her 3 books on love by her, all about love and communion, the female search for love, and men, masculinity, and love. And I think she really, Belle is one of my heroes, and she will be in this film. And she really looks at, you know, this is a question of a patriarchal system that is a dominator culture, a culture of power over, that's been in place for about 8,000 years, and we desperately need the rise of the feminine. And it's not just women's job, it's men's job too. It's not about becoming anemic. You know, Martin Luther King says, you know, power without love is reckless and abusive, but love without power is sentimental and anemic. So this love I'm talking about is a fierce love, and it is a feminine, and the feminine for me is interconnectedness, and it's and that to me is love, that coming into that place of connection with each other and the planet. So it's not just an intellectual, it's heart-centered.
And a fierce compassion, too.
And a fierce compassion, yeah, definitely. But the rise of Western women, yeah, there's much that they have to offer the world, for sure.
And I say that because of the freedom that we, you know,
that
going
women
back
have,
to the freedom
right.
that you're talking
about. And they can
about.
Model behavior that can then be picked up around the world, too, in
right.
societies where they're not able to have the freedom.
They're
to
not going to be shot for equality. Not wearing the burqa.
Yeah. So go for it, Western women.
I was one of two men at a conference a few weeks ago in Nevada City with 300 women.
Yeah.
And it was so inspiring and moving to be in that room, and I had really wished that there were a lot more men there that could really take it. And Nina Simon spoke, Gloria Felt, a lot of really amazing women spoke.
Yeah.
I found myself having a deeper ability to feel in the presence of these women than when I'm normally out. I was tender the whole day, you know, really raw tender.
I may make a film about the sacred masculine, because you know that it's such a serious issue that we as men have been taught that masculinity requires a disconnect from the heart, you know, and it's a tragedy for men and women and the planet, and that there's somehow a loss of power in being connected to the heart. That's why I think, you know, for men, the understanding of a fierce love is such a crucial understanding. We don't have to lose our core male or masculine essence. That's to be celebrated. But it doesn't require power over models. That's not inherently masculine. That's patriarchal.
Yeah,
big
absolutely.
Difference.
Oh,
yeah.
Very different.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I've been noticing is even more on the rise than it's been for the last 25 years, and that is the incredible focus on violence in our movies and in our language, in our media. I don't know how many end-of-the-world movies there are right now, but there are a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And even this movie that everyone is loving so much, The Avatar, for me, I left upset. I thought it was a violent movie, and not only that, it was a white male that saved the day.
Right.
You know, and there were a lot of good things. But it would have been so nice if they had, you know, connected like the planetary people were connecting with the source of life, and kind of like Powder when he put the guy's hand on the heart of the deer, and there was that kind of awakening. Instead of, again, promoting this violent solution to everything.
Yeah.
What can we do to begin to turn that around, and how are your films doing that?
Yeah, well, my films are all about that.
Yeah,
and countering that, and my life is about that too. I mean, I try to embody a different approach.
When they knocked down the trees in your film, I was just sobbing.
Yeah, the whole audience is usually sobbing at that point during the destruction of the farm. Yeah, and so the films actually do work towards that, creating, I mean, Evolve Love especially, I hope will be a film that actually is intended to open your heart to this sense of interconnectedness and break down this model of violence as a way, and the idea that evolution itself was violent. That's crap. You know, that was something that Darwin didn't even pose that. That was part of his theory, and then it was seized on by the Industrial Growth Society and promoted as an every man for himself justification. The story of the universe is cooperative, incredible, glorious
and
stories of cooperation and cooperation in diversity and diversity in community, systems of interconnected systems that we're all part of. The indigenous world describes that very beautifully. And probably you would find that model in the really healthy indigenous societies, you know, which you perhaps noted in Evo Morales, is that sense of a strong heart, you know, and a connection to the heart of the world.
It was really a contrast because I spent some time with he and Hugo Chavez. And of course, he's now Hugo Chavez's best friend, you know, and Chavez, who has done a lot of good things, had his arm around him, you know, my best friend, Evo, because there's something that Chavez can see in him, too, that is incredibly unique.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the reasons the Pachamama Alliance has been focusing for these last 15 years on supporting the indigenous so that we can, you know, bring together the southern or the indigenous perspective with the northern technology and ability to get things done, actually.
Yeah, yeah, there's definitely, you know, and that's a bit of a head and heart combination as well. But there's a deep wisdom in that culture as well. We definitely, the indigenous cultures around the world have been on the front lines of environmental destruction and have been on the front lines of trying to resist that destruction. And their values are the values we as a society, planetary society, need to return to and adopt. And yet we're not going to go back to, you know, we have to maintain what our unique perspective is. And I think synthesis is really exciting. And that's the order of the day right now. And there can be a harmony in taking the best of the different perspectives. And even Descartes, you know, and the Descartian vision that emerged with the Industrial Growth Society of separation was part of our journey of evolution, because it allowed us to step outside ourselves and see ourselves as separate. There was something in a value as a two-year-old needs to do of forming an ego.
Forming self-reflective consciousness, too.
And now we need to return to that conscious connection.
That we were born with.
That we were born with.
Mother,
it's
me,
like the,
no separation.
It's like
separation.
The hero's journey, right? Because we can't stay babies. We need to go from that journey of just that direct connection with all dissolved in it. And somehow come to a place of both and. Not either or. Yeah.
So one of the things that I left Copenhagen with was a feeling that was pretty hopeless at this point for a top-down solution, that it was primarily, I'd always hoped that it would be the top and the bottom would meet somewhere. But I think carbon trading and greed have pretty much destroyed the system. And then, of course, last week with the new Supreme Court ruling on allowing unlimited funds to go into the political process, pretty much destroys any hope of returning to or having a democracy that's a real democracy. What's your sense of where we're going in this country? If you had a crystal ball, where would you say, do you think it's just going to take a complete breakdown of the system? Or, you know, we had so much hope when Obama came into office, and yet, you know, he's just another person in the military-industrial complex that, like Carter.
I guess I don't see hope on a nation state level. Coming out of Copenhagen, that much was very clear. The change in the world is not going to happen at a nation state level. So we need to kind of step right outside it and have a ground up solution that's global in scope and that involves, you know, we're going to need like a billion, a 2 billion, a 5 billion person strong movement. You know, forget the top down model with the leaders and let's go for a horizontal change making. And that's the inspiration we can take from South America. Out of Copenhagen, Evo Morales proposed a people summit, which is going to take place in Bolivia, where we both should be.
Where we will be.
and that's really exciting. That's a model for how we need to just step outside of that nation state level and start just taking charge and taking action and looking for solutions that, you know, can go beyond the limitations that the feet-dragging corporations are going to do, because they just want to keep making as much money for as long as they can, and they don't care. They actually don't care if Rome burns.
It is so amazing to me
that
people can get that cut off. People who have children and grandchildren can really think that somehow they're going to survive when the rest of the world is going to... Right. I'm not sure what they think, actually.
They may be in denial. Their hearts are definitely shot, you know, and they may have limited scope morals. Like, my morality is to my shareholders, to the next quarter. You know, my ethics are as much money as my company can make in the next quarter. They have 4-month long attention spans, you know. They can't think the big picture. And that's that short-term thinking is a real problem. It's a myopia which is a deep, deep problem for us.
Now that's an essential part of being able to, in the face of all this, hold a vision. It's not a short-term vision.
Seven generations
about,
at least
that. I mean, right now, we're in for probably 1,000 or 2,000 years of response to changing just the CO2 content.
Yeah, Brian Swim says, you know, he can imagine, you know, thousands of years in the future, people looking back at the archaeological digs and saying, this was that time, like the die-off of the dinosaurs. This period, this very brief historical period we're in, was of, you know, vast, you know, time scale. Like the last extinction event of this scale, and you're right to talk about multiple adversity trends, global extinction is happening, it's real, it's huge, was on the scale of the dinosaurs. And this, for the first time, is being caused by humans. So we have a deep responsibility. So how can those people cut themselves off? I mean, Hannah Strong, who I interviewed last week in Crestone, she led the spiritual summit at Copenhagen. She's quite dramatic. She says, these leaders are going to be responsible for 5 billion murders. You know, there could be a vast reduction of the planet, you know. She was like, you know, Hitler did this many and Stalin did that many, Mao did that. These people are going to be responsible for a vast number. It's a crime, actually. It's a global crime.
Billions.
Yeah.
Not just millions, but billions.
Yeah.
That's hard to take in.
It is hard to take in.
Is just...
So you're here. You showed up. It's funny because some people say, I have no idea, I don't know, but they say that before you're born, you choose, you know, your hurdles, you know. So I think that all of us who are alive today are kind of overachievers. We decided to come, be born in history at a time of this tremendous challenge. But, you know, what's exciting is when you can rise to that challenge, and you know, I teach a workshop called Shine Your Fierce Light as I tour with Fierce Light. And the theme of the workshop is unwrapping your gifts in a time of crisis. And I believe that each and every person has multiple gifts to offer, and that we're here on this planet to unwrap our gifts. And no coincidence, when we step into what our true gift is, why we're here on Earth, what's our soul's purpose, we're also going to be of greatest service to the planet in this time.
Yeah, I don't think that anyone who actually finds their gifts won't find a needy audience for the expression of those gifts, someone to receive. There's no gift that's a real fundamental human gift that we carry that isn't something, whether it's filmmaking or doing a radio show or doing something healthy. You know, all of these things are so, so important.
And there's an urgency to wake up. You know, there's a call to wake up. And, if you know, it's easy to just sit on the couch, but, you know, this is not a time for that. It's also not a time to be in the cave for 12 years, you know. Be in the cave for a little while to get, you know, to get your strength, but we need to be out in the world doing. Andrew Cohen, who was going to be in Evolve Love, he says, you know, in the 60s they used to talk about be here now, but today we need to do here now, and that's really the call of these times. So as incredibly challenging as it is right now, it's also an incredible opportunity to really have a call to step into our truest selves.
It's an amazing call. I mean, when you think of that, we're moving into the sixth mass extinction at an unbelievably rapid pace in geological time, and that it's human created. And the jury is already in on that one. It's pretty clear, in spite of climate confusion and challenges, which is paid for by the fossil fuel industry. Yeah. But the thing to me that's exciting about that, Velcro, is that if we caused it, we are the only ones now who can keep it from completely destroying the planet. Mm-hmm. There's nothing else that's going to happen except for a major shift in consciousness towards a connected, earth-based spiritual awakening. Mm-hmm. And how great is that?
Yeah, as Joanna Macy says, quoting the Tibetans, this situation we're in was mano maya. It was mind-made. It was made by the human mind, so it can be unmade by the human mind. we can, you know, and this is, that's the excite, that's what's exciting about the wake up call, is because it's necessary, and it's also about being true to who you really are. So there's no greater reward, you know, than to actually step into embodied love. There's no greater reward than that, because it's really it's the only way you're going to be happy. You know, like, people are tremendously unhappy in our societies because none of these distractions, consumerism does not make you happy. Guess what? It doesn't make you happy.
Nor does 1 in 4 people being on mood elevators or the amazing statistics.
Incarceration industry, all the people in jails. You know, we have a very pathological society. And so we need to start asking, why is that? It's those two things I discovered in Scared Sacred, I think. You know, that source of meaning and taking action or being of service. Me, 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 me. You know, you used to talk about the me generation. Now I say it's like the me generation. That's just isolation. And isolation and separation and disconnection is a source of great unhappiness. It's connection, which is love, which is a source of happiness.
You mentioned being of service, and I have a whole other area of my life, which is teaching moving meditation and ecstatic dance, and really a dance church spiritual practice it's very large in our area, for our area.
Wonderful.
One of the things that I've been frustrated again and again, there was some point in my own life, personally, where I realized that the only thing there was to do was to be of service, that there was nothing else I was even interested in anymore. And I don't know where that was. Maybe it was in my age.
Right.
Whatever happened, it just took all the unhappiness that I had, and it vanished. But trying to create systems to instill that, I've been an utter failure at being able to do that and create what it was that was an experience for me. And I don't know what that is, but there's some point, something happens where people realize that a fulfilled life, you know, I forgot who said it, Schweitzer, I guess it was, said, "I don't know who among you will be happy, but I do know it's those of you who have sought and found how to serve." And yet this is something that people, "I don't have time for this. I've got my own problems to deal with. I can't save the world." You know, there's always these stories about it.
Don't try to save the world. Big mistake.
Right.
You can't do it. But, you know, in the law of simultaneity, you do your part and you do it well. As part of the whole, you're doing all parts. You know, just do your part and do it well. Now, service, you know, and does not mean, and should not mean, in my opinion, some big rock that you strap to your back and climb up and drag up the hill. It should bring you joy, and it should be in harmony with your own gifts. So there's so many ways to be of service in this planet, endless ways.
Well, motherhood is probably one of the greatest possibility, part of acts of service.
And fatherhood, boy.
And we need work on
that.
We really need to work on that one. I was just going to go there. That just brings incredible sense of joy to surrender to that. And
there's a million ways. And I think the other thing is that those ways can evolve and shift. But what I guess, you know, come back to is serving for the greater whole, I guess, being connected to the greater whole. When you see it as part of yourself, then it's just so natural. You know, that's awakening into service in a way. You know, when you come from a place of interconnected or love, then it's just natural that your every action, you're like, you know, how is this part of the dance? How is this the part of the life expansion that we need, the creative life force, as opposed to, you know, how is this part of the contractive force? How am I aligning myself with the necrophilia of our society? You know, you can tell the difference, you know, and that's the difference between being fulfilled or not.
Yeah. Anna Laurent, the journalist, was covering the trial of Adolf Eichmann. She wrote that she had expected to go there and see evil incarnate, that this was the man responsible for these incredible atrocities and all these deaths. And she was sitting in the courtroom when they brought him in, and she said she was shocked because he was just this nice little old man who looked like someone's grandfather, probably was really good to his grandkids. Yeah. And she said the worst that he could be accused of was being thoughtless. And I thought, wow, what a statement, being thoughtless. Mm-hmm. And yet, when you think about it, it is, you know, we are doing everything we can to not think at that heart level. I'm not talking about the head level.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the think with every pore of your body. How can we awaken that? And again, I come back to the why I'm in media is because the insurmountable, seemingly insurmountable odds of five corporations basically owning mainstream media, which is supposed to belong to the people.
Yeah.
How do we rise above thoughtlessness and, mm-hmm. and our work is our teaching, but mm-hmm. as a society, how do we get beyond these ways that we numb ourselves, mm-hmm. Booze and alcohol and drugs and painkillers and all these different things
television,
that we used,
yeah.
and television, the worst narcotic of all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, how do we get by that? I mean, that's what you're trying to do. That's what I'm trying to do.
And that's why I agree media is important. I consider myself a media activist and have my whole life. And it's, you know, and there's, what's exciting though is there is a democratization of the media happening as well. You know, we also have the rise like never before of social media, social networks. And I don't think Facebook is just a waste of time. I actually think that there is real interconnectedness and community, alternative community, building on these social networking platforms, which can actually counter media messages, you know, and we can start to have horizontal messaging happening across these uncontrolled terrains where the corporate presence, when it shows up, kind of looks out of place. You know, it's like the guy at the party who's like, you know,
wearing the
naked
plaid.
Or not naked. I don't know, which are depending on the party.
The plaid leisure suit.
Right, whatever.
Or something.
That's actually a bad metaphor because I think anyone should dress however the hell they want.
That's true.
But anyways, you know what I mean? Like they just don't, they don't quite fit in. And so that's a beautiful thing, you know, that we have these people zones for the people. And I guess I'm coming back to that in media, in our social organizing and everything, we need to come back to the people.
Yeah. Here's my issues with that. Uh-huh. And I know Bill McKibben is coming out with a book. I'm really anxious to read what, because he's really saying exactly what you're saying and expanding it in great detail. I have a couple issues with it.
Yeah.
First of all, it seems to me that so many people are disconnected electronically, uh-huh. and that I was in Venice in San Marcos Square, and there was this couple walking across, dressed to the nines across the plaza there, and talking on their cell phones. And my friend looked at me and said, "Do you think they're talking to each other?" And there's this huge disconnect, this electronic disconnect. So that's one issue that I have. The other issue I have is that billions of dollars are going into the internet and the social medias to actually foment dissent and to create a sense of question around some of these issues that are up. And, you know, as well as I do, when we research on the internet, you're going to be finding all these fake grassroots groups that are rising up and that are funded by the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah.
So I kind of question whether this isn't leading us down the wrong road in some ways.
Well, it's as with most things these days, it's a both and scenario. It's not an either or scenario. And I think it's like these terrains, you know, these are landscapes that become inhabited by these different forces. And I like Matthew Fox when he talks about the forces of biophilia and the forces of necrophilia and how these forces can be used in either way, you know. The global demonstrations that happened that were organized by via the internet are tremendous. You know, the mass days of action that happened, those were never possible before. And they're not just online. They're like people organizing and then getting into the streets. We're seeing that happen. We're seeing these kinds of possibilities of real movement. So it can't just stay in cyberspace, you know, but it can be a launching pad, you know, to real action and real connection. It's both and like everything that we have that has a shadow.
Yeah, I guess it's like you can build a house for someone with a hammer or murder them.
Right.
Yeah. It's the
I do think that these tools of democratization of the media are really important because the media is getting controlled and we need to constantly be aware of that and support and disseminate and look for alternative sources of media. And you know, as a filmmaker, I don't have, you know, I do feature films that go out in movie theaters and I don't have the resources to have the huge advertising budgets. But with the help of social media, I'm able to get audiences out for my films. Fierce Light ran for like 8 weeks in Vancouver in Canada and 4 weeks in Toronto, which is a long time for a feature documentary in commercial cinemas. And
it got a lot of recognition too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They all have.
Yeah.
It won awards, and it's still going strong, and it's still being shown in the grassroots level a lot, and it's going to be on Link TV in the spring, and on the Movie Network in Canada in March as well. So
that's great. It keeps going on Netflix too.
Yeah, it's on Netflix now. Okay, yeah, you can get on Amazon. So you know, but the spread of the film has really, a lot of it has been through word of mouth. yeah, it really has been, and I'm so grateful for that because I make my films to help create social change, and those aren't necessarily the kind of films that you're going to get big advertising dollars behind. Yeah,
I think we put a trailer of it out in the Well of Light, our newsletter, which is
cool.
Only about 5,000 people, but that's 5,000 more people that if they clicked on it.
Yeah,
you know, got a chance to see something.
So this kind of spread of information is and spread of possibility, I think, is very hopeful. Any way we can circumnavigate and get around and over and under these structures of destruction that are dominating us, you know, and maintain our sense of humor and our spirit and our heart, you know, in the face of the challenges, and then you know, peak oil, these things happen. We're gonna have massive social shifts. And the fabric of society is going to shift. And we are also seeing shifts at a nation state level. It's not just, you know, it is starting to change there as well. In other countries, more. But Obama, for all that he's been hamstrung, was that guy who used to, you know, Obama is a world-centric president. You know, he actually, that's rare, you know, in America. He was somebody who actually understands that the United States of America lives on planet Earth with other humans, you know, and it's not like the me and my sandbox mentality, you know. And that's an important shift. There's many important shifts. And he's still hamstrung.
He's totally hamstrung. But he really worked in Copenhagen to try to make something happen in spite of he didn't bring much to the table, but he did try to work it. And I think one of the issues for me is it's great that we have someone that wants to communicate, that wants to connect, that wants to reach out. I think is very authentic in his caring for people. And somehow we often say, oh, well, now we've got Obama in, the job is done.
Oh, yeah.
Just
that's
the
big
opposite.
Mistake. I was actually writing a book, and I think the title is no longer going to be useful because his popularity is not high enough, but called BY Obama. Be your own Obama. You know, at the beginning of when there was so much excitement, I was like, I could see that everyone was... You're saying, okay, great, now you're going to take care of it all. It's a problem that people have with activists, too. You know, the idea that, okay, the activists, they're dealing with the environment. The environmentalists, right, that's their job, right? And no. You know, those days are over. We all need to take action.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. One of the startling statistics that I just read was that half the planet is under 25.
Wow.
I was amazed. I had no idea of that.
That's interesting.
3 billion people under the age of 25.
Oh.
What are your thoughts about the power of the youth movement?
That sounds hopeful. When you said that, my initial thought was, that sounds hopeful.
Yeah.
The entrenched patriarchy, which is one of the big problems, is actually diminishes the younger people get. Like, a lot of youth as they grow up are much more non-patriarchal. They're breaking old paradigms. And that's important. That's exciting. I have a great connection with youth. I often show my films in high schools and talk, and I even teach meditation in high school classes when I go to visit, and you know, some of the kids are like, oh, I breathe? I didn't know I breathed. Wow, this is fierce. But I'm excited by the depth of understanding that youth that I encounter have. And I think one of the reasons my films speak to them so much is because my films really are global in scope and address the global crises and offer hope. And they're not really getting hope, you know, and they're growing up knowing that their future is at stake. You know, the older people might be dead and gone before it really goes down in flames. But they're probably going to be around. In, you know, the people that are 20 now, you know, in 70 years, what the heck is this place going to look like if the planet keeps heating up the way it is? They are inheriting a big mess, and that gives them a greater sense of urgency, which we all need. We need urgency, but we need to stay calm.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly
what you mean.
Out.
Yeah. James O'D, who's a new friend of mine, and I just interviewed him for Evolve Love as well. I was up at his place in Crestone, and I'm a big fan of him, of his. I think he's fantastic work. But he's just written a book on creative stress, and he says that we need to eat stress for breakfast. You know, stress is like there's negative stress where we look at stress as this thing to combat and, you know, to contract around. But creative stress is like use it to fuel you creatively. How can you transform? And this is the story of Scared Sacred. If a Hiroshima survivor can do it, we can.
Well, Velcro, I think we could talk for hours together, and I would enjoy that, but we're getting close to the end of our hour. Anything you'd like to tell our audience about what they can do to get more in touch with their gift, to make the difference that they want to make, to know that they make a difference? What would your words be to them of advice from your experience that you've had?
Okay. You have the power to transform your situation. Don't wait around for somebody else. It begins within your own heart. You are not lacking anything. You are whole, and you have a tremendous gift to offer this planet, and we're waiting for your gift. Bring it out and celebrate. And celebrate the beauty of the planet, and that's a cause to take action in whatever way works for you. Yeah. And you know, if you want to visit my websites as well, that there's lots of information.
Yes, give us your website
there.
So we can.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which one?
Fiercelight.org. For Fierce Light and lots of spiritual activist resources. ScaredSacred.org, about the movie Scared Sacred. And the most stuff is on VelcroRipper.com. And remember that Velcro has a W at the end, like crow. So I am associated more with a crow than a fabric in my own heart.
Velcro, wonderful to have you on Conversations. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Great to be here.